They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, Rohan Nadkarni is back in. He is out in California, where he will be spending this NBA season and the foreseeable future. Are you now a Californian for life, Rohan? Is that what we should describe you as?
I don't know about for life, but I'm glad that you brought up I'm living in California, Chris, because I wanted to make sure that you were aware that I live in Los Angeles, because a lot of people reached out to me to wish me good luck on the move. A lot of people reached out to me when they knew I got to Los Angeles to ask how everything was going. You know, a simple, do you feel settled in? And this is the first time I'm hearing from you in a long time. So it wasn't clear to me that you actually knew that I moved to California.
Okay, first of all, you're an incredibly needy person. Let's put that on the table, number one. Number two, I think we've had this version of the conversation, like you were going, you know, you're looking forward to it. I didn't know exactly when you went, but I knew you were going. I didn't know you needed like my stamp of approval for you to be okay with moving to California.
Let's not act like me being needy is a new development, all right? So just a simple, hey man, hope you're like in LA would have sufficed. But it's fine, I get it. You're a busy guy. You know, I'm sure you've been up to all kinds of stuff this summer, so don't worry about it. You know, I'm sure the next time I make such a big cross-country move, you'll help pack and all that stuff. So I'm not worried about it. But yes, I'm in Northern California, except for a brief fire scare this morning. Everything has been going great.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to come help you pack and, you know, support you as you bounce around the country there. But LA, of course, the epicenter kind of the NBA universe next season, with the Clippers being really good, the Lakers potentially being a disaster. Maybe they're better than I expect, but we'll see about that. So it'll be really interesting covering those two teams out in LA. All right, so Rohan, there's not a ton of fresh NBA news to kind of dive into here. We're in that sort of dead period when it comes to the NBA, but I thought we could do some kind of NBA superlatives as we go into this upcoming season, which is going to be, I think, one of the most interesting seasons that we've had in a while. We're going to have a lot of parity, you know, 7, maybe 8 teams can realistically go into the season believing they have a chance to win a championship, maybe more if an injury or two comes up. So it's interesting. So let's use that word kind of as the jumping off point. Give me your most interesting team going into the 19-20 season.
So like you said, there are 7 or 8 teams that have a realistic chance, or at least believe they have a realistic chance at being a title contender this year. And you could go in a lot of directions with this answer. So I apologize for going the obvious route, but I did just move to Los Angeles, and I have to go with the Lakers on this one. And part of the reason why I think the Lakers are more interesting than the Clippers is the Clippers kind of resemble a normal championship contender. They have 2 stars. They have a balanced roster. They have a championship coach, a really forward-thinking front office. The Clippers check a lot of boxes. The Lakers, on the other hand, are a soap opera. I mean, it's fascinating what's going on here. It's kind of unclear what the relationship between Frank Vogel and LeBron is going to be like. We also have the LeBron James Anthony Davis dynamic, where we have to see, you know, LeBron in the past has taken time to get going with superstar teammates. It's never really clicked right away from him. So we have that subplot. Then we have the rest of the roster, which, while it makes more sense than last year's mishmash of veterans that they brought in, it's still not a perfect roster by any means. We also have the subplot of LeBron James's career. I mean, where is it going? Is he still in his prime? Is he on the decline? Was last year a fluke? What's Anthony Davis going to do in his first season with real stakes? What's going on with the front office? Do people still trust Rob Pelinka? Is Rich Paul going to get involved here somehow again? So there are just so many storylines with the Lakers that it's hard not to pick them. I mean, there's just so much to unpack. I don't even know where to begin. I do think they're going to be really good. I think they're going to have one of the best closing fives in the league. I don't know that they're going to be a deep team. I don't know that they can sustain a lot of injuries, but when they put their best five on the floor, I think they're going to be able to compete with anyone. It's just going to be so interesting to see if they can hold everything else together in place to get to that point, you know, in a season, in a postseason, where all that matters is those five players on the floor, because there's just so much surrounding them at all times.
Yeah, look, the Lakers, of course, are kind of that low-hanging fruit on the interesting team spectrum here. And I look at them, and look, I can see a path where they are a legit contender. That front court is for real. I mean, LeBron, Kuzma, Anthony Davis, that's legit. Who knows what they're going to get out of Dwight Howard? I will never, until Dwight Howard shows me that he's capable of being a contributor on a winning team, as he hasn't been for the better part of the last 7-8 years, I'm not really going to buy into him. But you have to also look at that Western Conference. I mean, if we assume that Oklahoma City falls out of the playoff mix, which I'm not entirely sure about yet, I think with Chris Paul there and that group of players, Gallo is still a good player, Steven Adams, good player, maybe Roberson comes back, contributes, I think they're going to be in the playoff mix. The Lakers are going to have to, you know, kind of leapfrog some teams to get in there, because the other seven seem like they're locked in. I mean, Clippers, Spurs, Jazz, Rockets, Blazers, Nuggets, Warriors. I mean, I think those are playoff teams at the very least. Then you look at the bottom of it.
The Spurs are going to be tough, but I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the Spurs are still a playoff team. I mean, I you know, they're going to get you know, some guys back, and they're still good. But like, I don't think there are as many gimmies as there were last year. I think Dallas is going to be better. I think the Pelicans are going to surprise some teams. I think Minnesota is going to be a little bit better now. They're a little more drama-free. You know, the bottom line with the Lakers is that they can't have too many lulls during the season. They can't have too big of kind of a learning curve with this group, because they could fall far enough behind that they could have a tough time climbing back into that playoff race, I think.
No, it's a good point, and we saw it happen to an extent last year. They got off to a big start. They were surprising a lot of people. LeBron went down with the injury, and they never really recovered from that. Their situation's already a little perilous. It's not that DeMarcus Cousins was their third most important player. They just can't afford to lose a rotation guy for a sustained period of time, because they just can't replace them. They don't have anyone who can kind of step up and give them these minutes. Their rotation is already so, so tight. And I see a lot of people saying, just play Anthony Davis at center. That's where he should be playing, and I hear that. I just don't think it's good for him to be playing center every night. I think that's going to take a much bigger physical toll on him than to be playing power forward and to be kind of taking that easier defensive assignment for much of the regular season. And I know that sounds like a little bit of a cop-out, but this is a team built for the playoffs, and they're so thin that they have to protect their stars, because they went through that experience last year with LeBron. So I don't know that I think it's quite as a toss-up as you. I do think they have the ability to leapfrog some teams. What I'd be worried about with them most is, I mean, especially if LeBron or Davis goes down, it's going to be a huge issue. But even if they lose one of their rotation guys, they're kind of in trouble, because they don't have any easy avenues to replace guys if they go down. And this is a team with very little depth.
Yeah, it certainly does. I'm going to go to the Eastern Conference with my most interesting team. I'm looking at Philadelphia right now. I mean, on paper, you can see a path where the Sixers compete with Milwaukee as the top team in the Eastern Conference, a conference that's now more open, you know, than it has ever been before, with Kawhi defecting from Toronto. You make Milwaukee the favorite, but Philadelphia is really intriguing, and it's pretty easy to see how things break for them one way or the other. If it's two things, really. One, shooting. They lose J.J. Redick. They're going to plug probably Josh Richardson into that starting lineup, and they're going to have a huge, long, highly skilled defensive starting lineup. But they're not going to have the shooting that they had last year, because Redick was such a big part of what that team did. So if they can find the shooting, and maybe it comes from Al Horford, who's been a very good perimeter shooter. You know, I had somebody bring up to me earlier this week that the Sixers, like, their front court is so much better at shooting than their backcourt, like with Simmons and Richardson compared to Embiid and Al Horford. But maybe they get enough shooting from those two guys. And the other factor that's the wild card is Simmons. With Jimmy Butler gone, Ben Simmons is going to have to become the alpha. He is going to have to become the guy that you can give the ball to late in games and have him make plays. And look, he's turned into a marvelous player, a max-level player. He's an excellent defensive player. He's an excellent playmaker. He's a freight train on the open floor, but he's still not a shooter. And I've seen all the videos this offseason, and that's kind of the new thing, right, where players post videos of them doing something good. I've seen the videos of Ben Simmons making three-point shots. He is going to have to do that. He doesn't have to be a sharpshooter, but he's going to have to be a threat from the outside this season for this team to become a championship team. They've cast their die with this group. Al Horford was a big money signing. Embiid and Simmons are max contract players. They need Ben Simmons, though, to be a takeover type of guy, to be what Jimmy Butler was for them last season. If he is, they're a team that can beat Milwaukee. If he's not, they're a team, I think, that can lose in the second round to somebody.
It's really interesting, and I'm glad you brought up Philly, because I feel like I am way less excited about them than almost every other person I've talked to, which definitely doesn't bode well for me personally, a high-risk, high-reward situation. But their biggest problem in the playoffs was their half-court offense, and it feels like they're going away from that. And what worries me about them is, you talk about Simmons needs to take that next step. I agree. The problem is, when you sign a guy like Al Horford, Philly's biggest problem has always been, in my opinion, the push and pull between how Simmons wants to play and how Embiid wants to play. You know, Simmons is an open-court, fast-paced guy. The team plays a lot faster when he's playing without Embiid. As soon as Embiid gets on the floor, the pace slows down. Embiid wants touches in the post, and he deserves that. He's an incredibly effective player. Horford's only going to slow down that pace even more. And they're even more of a half-court team now with Al Horford there. And I just, what does that do to the effectiveness of Ben Simmons? You're forcing him to play in the half-court more often. For all of Jimmy Butler's flaws, I mean, can he be the best player on a championship team? They needed him desperately in the playoffs to bail them out in the half court. I mean, I think he was maybe not their best player. I still think Embiid was their best player, but in some ways, their most important player in numerous offensive situations because of what he could do in the half court. You know, in down the stretch of a fourth quarter playoff game, what does their half court offense look like right now? Because Redick was also so instrumental in getting their guys open, getting guys open looks because of all the attention he commanded. And his two-man game with Embiid was super successful. They don't have that anymore. I mean, Richardson's a good shooter, but he's obviously not Redick. I'm really concerned about them offensively. Now, what I am discounting here and was worth bringing up is I think they're obviously going to be great defensively. Embiid's a perennial defensive player of the year candidate, as is Horford. You mentioned Simmons. I mean, they're going to have the length. They're going to have versatility. But I'm just so concerned about what they're going to look like offensively and what signing a guy like Horford is going to do to Simmons down the stretch of games that I can't picture it working right now. Who's going to have the ball in their hands? Is it going to be Simmons? We saw Simmons was in that dunker spot against Toronto. I mean, he was roaming the baseline while Jimmy had the ball in his hands. Who's going to initiate the offense? Is it going to be Simmons? Is that going to be the best role for him in a half-court situation? I'm a little concerned about how it's all going to fit together for that.
Well, I think Horford can initiate some of the offense because he did that a lot in Boston. His playmaking, I think, is really underrated. But, you know, it comes down to Simmons. And, look, maybe they'll have to get creative with their lineups. I mean, Tobias Harris, I think, is better as a mismatch-creating four than he is as a traditional three, but he's going to have to make some shots for that team. So I think you're right. Offensively, in general, like they're going to have to prove that they can score. I think their defense is going to keep them in a lot of games and win them a lot of games because they can stop anybody in this league. But if they go up against a team that can score on them, they're going to have some problems there. All right, let's look ahead to specific players and a specific player. Let's look at that might have the most pressure on them this season. I'm going to start on this one. I'm going to go with Jason Tatum in Boston because, you know, the Celtics, they rallied, I thought, nicely in the offseason with signing Kemba Walker. And I think Kemba I think he's going to be a great fit with that team. I think Kemba's shown in the last few years that he's just about winning. And I think after having to carry Charlotte for as long as he did, I think Kemba will welcome, you know, being part of a team there. But, you know, Boston, they lost some firepower, no question about it, with Kyrie and with Al Horford. And if you look at the roster, yes, you can probably count on Gordon Hayward to get even better, you know, with a full offseason of working out under his belt. But Jason Tatum is the guy that I think will determine if this Celtics team can get to a conference finals or maybe even an NBA finals, or if they wind up being kind of first-round fodder. I mean, I don't know that he took a step back last year, but he didn't take that step forward that many people expected. And with Horford gone and with Kyrie gone, he's going to have the ball in his hands. He's going to have to create offense for himself. He's going to have to show that he's more of a playmaker. I think that's another step in his development. I think this pressure on Jason Tatum to kind of become that star that so many out there projected him to be.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I do think Tatum's, you know, last year was a little bit of a lateral step for him. And I do think the new situation in Boston should help him. It seems like the roles will be a little bit better defined this year. I do think not having Kyrie there is going to help them. And I also think there's some pressure on him because, you know, this is something that you and I have talked about before. You know, whether you think Boston, you know, should or should not have traded for Anthony Davis or, you know, taken that huge risk and included Tatum in the deal, you know, this is a franchise that has kind of hitched their future to his potential in some ways. I'm not saying that, you know, their future title prospects, you know, solely depend on his development, but that's going to be a pretty big part of it. So I do agree that if he's the crown jewel of kind of what they want to be moving forward, he's kind of been that untouchable piece for them, then he does have to take that big step. You know, otherwise Boston, which, you know, laid out all these beautiful plans and has seen them go awry to an extent the last couple of years. I mean, he's kind of, in some ways, their last hope for kind of realizing that potential that they've expected to have, you know, these last few years with all the moves Danny Ainge has made. You know, he's made it a point to protect Jason Tatum. And if he can't do that, then you do have to kind of start wondering, well, what is this team's ceiling? What is their future? How do they kind of get back to that finals contender status?
That's another team, too, that, you know, we talk about Philly being great defensively. Boston's going to take a step back. And over the last few years, they've really prided themselves on being, you know, top five, even number one in the league. I think one of those years defensively, you know, that's not going to happen this year. I mean, they swapped out Aaron Baines and Al Horford for Enes Kanter, and I don't know, like, who is playing the four spot with that team. Robert Williams, he going to get reps? Are they going to put Tatum in that role? I mean, I think Kanter's good for them offensively, but, you know, that defensive front court, they're going to have to figure some things out because I don't know how they get stops defensively with those guys up front. All right, give me your player with the most pressure on him this year.
Kanter, by the way, for a full season at starting five is going to be really interesting. My player with the most pressure, I don't know if it's the perfect term for this guy, but maybe it's attention, but I'm going with Russell Westbrook. Because, you know, they obviously swapped him out with Chris Paul in Houston, and that's going to be a fascinating experiment. I think that a lot of guys' futures are in some way going to be distilled onto Russell. I think whether it's Daryl Morey's future in Houston, you know, there are some kind of rumblings, you know, how much of a long-term leash does he have there with the new owner in place? I think James Harden is in his prime right now. He's obviously one of the best scorers players in the league. How many more years does he have at this elite level? And now it's tied to Russ instead of Chris Paul. I mean, we saw that they were able to move Paul. So, you know, it's not that he's attached to Russell Westbrook forever, but, you know, the Rockets kind of went all in on this team with this move. They re-signed Eric Gordon. You know, Russ is supposed to be their second star. He's another guy. I mean, it's obviously not the same as Dwight Howard, but he's going to have to prove in a way that he hasn't for the entirety of his career, that he's willing to adjust his game. And now this can go both ways, because on one hand, maybe the fact that he's in a new situation will make it easier to do that. Maybe the fact that he's no longer the face of this organization, he's in a different place, you know, a place where he wasn't drafted, it will be that wake-up call that he needs to become a different player, to be the player that, you know, is in that secondary role. On the other hand, Russell Westbrook has had everything catered to his needs from the moment he got into the league with Oklahoma City. And he still kind of wasn't willing to bend a little bit to adjust his style of play when his team needed it the most. And I'm curious to see if he's willing to do that with the Rockets when he feels like a little bit of an outsider. So that is, to me, a super interesting situation. You could have argued if the Rockets simply brought everyone back that they would have been right up there as, you know, the co-favorites in the West. I mean, they were that good in the second half of last season. They were that good in Chris Paul's first year in Houston. So I'm really curious to see how that Russell Westbrook, James Harden duo plays out. And if Russ is willing to do things that he hasn't been willing to do for much of his career, and if it even works just from a basketball standpoint, I mean, a team that prides itself on shooting, getting one of the worst three-point shooters of all time, it's just going to be a fascinating experiment.
Oh, I agree. I mean, how those guys play together, I'm still not sure. I mean, I'll be interested to see when training camp comes around how Mike D'Antoni kind of schemes this. But on paper, Russell Westbrook is not the guy you want playing off of James Harden. You want a shooter playing off of Harden. That's not Russell's game. And the whole your turn, my turn thing, is that going to work? Is that the way they're going to go? I don't know. I mean, the fact they didn't bring Chris Paul back and run that group back speaks volumes about, you know, what that relationship was like between Paul and Harden and maybe Paul and the franchise. It just, because I'm with you. I think if you brought that crew back and they were all healthy, you know, that's still a team that 2 years ago, you know, made a run at Golden State in the conference finals. And now they're rolling the dice big time and tying themselves to two guys with huge contracts who have had success playing together in the past, but that was a lifetime ago. And James Harden was a completely different player in their time in Oklahoma City. So I'm with you. That's probably an interesting player, an interesting team to watch moving forward. All right, some people think that all diet and weight loss plans are the same, but that's because they haven't tried Noom. Noom is a new, totally different approach to losing weight and getting healthy that uses psychology and small goals to help you change your habits, make it easy to lose the weight, and keep it off for good. Noom combines the power of technology with real human support, offering as little or as much help as you want along the way. And since Noom is an app, it's always with you and easy to use, which makes it super easy to stay on track and reach your goals. It's just as simple to get started. Just go online, answer a few quick questions, and they'll create a personalized program for you. Noom can help you lose your old way of thinking about food and dieting. So, what do you have to lose? Visit Noom.com/podcast. That's Noom.com/podcast and start your 14-day trial today. Change your habits, change your mind, change for good with Noom. All right, let's talk about the coaching box there. And the most interesting, or the coach with the most pressure on them. And I'm going to go out to your neck of the woods again and take that low-hanging fruit as well. And that's Frank Vogel. Because, you know, Frank Vogel is walking into, I don't know what Frank Vogel is walking into. I'm not sure Frank Vogel knows what he's walking into right now. He's, you know, taking on a job, or took on a job that originally was earmarked for either Monty Williams or Ty Lue. Vogel gets it. And I've been on record, you know, my feelings about Vogel and his coaching ability are pretty well known. People that listen to this podcast and read my stuff, I think he's an excellent coach. I know people, you got to look back at what he did with that Indiana team, taking over a team that was floundering under Jim O'Brien at the end and turning them into a playoff team and then a back-to-back conference finalist. The only team that Pacers group in those 2 years lost to in the playoffs was LeBron James and the Miami Heat. In those years, LeBron and Miami beat everybody. So I don't think there's any issues with him losing to that team. But he's now got to take on a situation where he's got to mold this team together. He's got to find a role for Dwight Howard. He's got to deal with the constant chatter that Jason Kidd is going to take his job. He's got to look up to a front office that still remains kind of, I don't know what the word is for the Lakers front office right now, but I think there's no question of any coach in the league, Frank Vogel has the most pressure on him going into this season. I think, you know, if he makes it through like the first month and they play pretty well, I think Frank Vogel would turn out to be the right coach for this team. But if they wind up really struggling in that first month, he could turn out to be one of the first coaches let go.
Yeah, I think it's Vogel too. I'm going to throw out another name in a second, but just a couple words on Vogel. First of all, I agree with you. I think he's an awesome coach. I think he's a very underrated coach. Those Indiana teams were incredible. I mean, he had LeBron spooked those years. I mean, he had LeBron practicing floaters to try to beat Roy Hibbert. I mean, those Indiana teams are really good. I think when LeBron's career is all said and done, one thing we're going to look back on and wonder is how he never formed a relationship with a coach in the way Steph Curry did, you know, in a way Tim Duncan did, in a way even Michael Jordan did with Phil Jackson. I mean, LeBron's never just had that one guy, and I think that's been an issue for him. And Volk was entering a situation where last season Rich Paul was complaining to the commissioner of the NBA that he didn't like LeBron's coach. I mean, it's a powder keg, and I'm nervous for Frank Vogel. I feel bad for Frank Vogel. I don't know that Jason Kidd is the answer either. That is going to be a wild situation, and I hope that he's given time to do work there, because I do think he's a very good coach, and I do think he can get a lot out of that roster. It's just always weird to me when you bring in a guy that's not LeBron's guy, because he's shown in the past that he loses patience very quickly. Another name I want to throw out there is Brett Brown. I think Brett Brown's been a great coach for the Sixers. I thought it was absurd that his job was on the line last year when it literally came down to a few bounces on the rim. I think he's a really good coach, and I'm worried because, again, the Sixers have locked themselves into this core and are clearly going for this title right now. You know, since Elton Brand took over, the front office has been very, very aggressive, and I think they're going to expect themselves to be the favorites. I think they expect themselves to make a finals run this year. And if it's finals or bust, it's going to be tough for Brett Brown. I mean, to his advantage, he finally gets a full training camp with this group. I mean, think about how many times they remade the roster just last season with all the trades, and he still had all those expectations. At least he should get a full year with the same group for the first time in a while. But I do think the expectations for Brett Brown are going to be pretty high.
Yeah, Brett Brown's narrative is crazy. Like, he takes over a tanking team and manages to survive it. He survives a new boss in Jerry Colangelo and Brian Colangelo and survives them, and he's still there with as much power as he ever had before. But yeah, there's a lot of pressure. He's going to have to, as we talked about earlier, develop that team into a winner very quickly because they've kind of locked themselves in with that group. All right, let's finish with a team that might surprise you, and I'll let you go first on this one. Give me a team out there that you think is going to be maybe a little bit better, or even a little bit worse than some people think.
So I haven't decided if this team is going to be better or worse than people think yet, which I know is a little weird, but it's truly like confounding to me where this team's going to go. And it's a team no one has talked about all summer. The Toronto Raptors, the defending NBA champions, have been one of the most boring teams in the you know, summer after they lost Kawhi. I have no idea what's going to happen with this group. I think some people are expecting Siakam to take a leap. I think they're still going to be very good, but I mean, if Kyle Lowry gets hurt, I don't know which way this is going to go. On one hand, I could see them still being really, really good. I mean, they had a great record without Kawhi last year. Nick Nurse is a good coach. They have a lot of depth. At the same time, can't you also imagine a little bit of a championship hangover for guys like Serge Ibaka, Marc Gasol, Kyle Lowry? Are they going to have that same hunger, that same drive, especially with Kawhi gone? Couldn't you also see them taking a big step back? Maybe guys get hurt. They're going to be just so much older now. I have no idea which way the Raptors are going to go. And it's weird because I can't think of a time in the NBA in the last decade, really. I mean, maybe the Mavericks were the last team that was like this, where the next year no one even considered them in the championship conversation. The Mavericks, the 2011 Mavericks, had to be the last team where people were just like, we have no idea what to make of this team now because it's so wildly different than what it just was. I mean, typically that doesn't happen to champions in the NBA. I just think that's going to be a really weird situation. And I have no idea which way it's going to cut.
Yeah, I mean, I think Kyle Lowry can perform and give you more in an enhanced role. And I think Siakam is going to be better. I think the problem with predicting any kind of success for Toronto is that I do think that a lot of guys there are available. Now, the Raptors are not going to take on salary beyond this season, which, you know, you've got Lowry, who doesn't have an extension yet, but maybe he gets one. You've got Gasol in the last year of his contract. You got Ibaka in the last year of his contract. I could see a scenario, you know, before February where one or more of those guys gets moved in exchange for another expiring contract and maybe some draft sweetener for a team that's trying to make a run. So I don't know that team is solidified, but, you know, there's a lot of veterans in that group. And if Siakam takes the kind of leap that people project, maybe they could be, they could surprise you. I'm going to go, though, to a team I touched on briefly earlier. That's Oklahoma City. And, you know, they trade Paul George and they trade Russell Westbrook. And you would assume any other team that trades two players on that level would be tearing the whole thing down. And maybe ultimately that's what Oklahoma City is going to do in the next year or so. But as currently constituted, they're not tanking. Like, they're not. And because they can't. Like, they've got too many guys that can play. You've still got a strong front court with Steven Adams and Gallo, who, if he's healthy, is a legit scoring four man. You get Shai Gilgeous-Alexander in the Clippers trade, and anyone you talk to in this league tells you that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is a flat-out stud. Chris Paul, if he's motivated and he's satisfied being there and he's healthy, still a high-level NBA point guard. You need some guys to take steps forward. Maybe Roberson coming back would be a boost for them. I mean, you need Terrence Ferguson, another guy to take a jump forward. But I can see that Oklahoma City team, after losing Westbrook and Paul George, competing for a playoff spot. I can see that. Now, one injury could derail the whole thing. And if they do decide to deal Chris Paul to, say, Miami before the end of the season, I could see that. I can certainly see that deal happening. And that would take a lot of success out the window. But I think Oklahoma City could be surprising. They're not going to be a team that sinks to the bottom of the Western Conference standings, Rohan.
Yeah, I'm with you right there. And I do think this is something that people have now touched on a bit. And, you know, I wrote about it with, you know, right after it happened. As long as they have Chris Paul, they're not going to be tanking. And I do think there are arguments to be made that Chris Paul's not a better player than Russell Westbrook at this point in their careers. But in some ways, he works better within a framework of certain offenses. I mean, like a Chris Paul, Steven Adams pick and roll is going to be very good. If Ferguson takes that next step as a shooter, if Shai takes that next step as a shooter, I think they're going to have like a very solid starting five at the very, very least. And I do think Billy Donovan maybe is able to breathe a sigh of relief right now. They're going to be really interesting. I do think it comes down to whether they trade Chris Paul or not. You know, how far their success goes, because as long as he's there, like you said, they're not going to be tanking. They might be, and it's possible, and I don't think they're going to do this. I do think eventually they're going to trade Paul, but wouldn't it be interesting if they kept him and tried to rebuild this on the fly without trying to get very bad first? I think that's very unlikely, but that would just be an interesting way of doing things. But as long as Paul is there, they're not going to just all of a sudden start losing a bunch of games. It is going to be very difficult for them to get into the playoffs, but I could absolutely see them being in that fight for the eighth seed throughout the season, as long as they don't make any major trades.
Yeah, look, I don't know who's available out there via trade at this point that would be an impact player, but they're in a position with all their draft picks to be opportunistic if that comes about. I don't think that's the plan right now. I think, you know, rebuilding via the draft, which Sam Presti has had some significant success doing in his time as the GM with the Thunder, I think that's the plan. But they're kind of the new Boston, you know, in that they're just kind of hoarding all these draft picks and have a war chest that a lot of teams that might be looking to deal a star could be interested in. Rohan, always appreciate it, man. Get yourself some fresh board shorts, new sandals, take up surfing. I don't know what Californians do for fun in September, but, you know, enjoy, my friend.
I don't know if I could say it on this podcast, but there's something a lot of Californians do when they have a lot of downtime that I think everyone is going to partake in, you know, until the NBA season starts.
Yeah, probably not something you want to specify on the old podcast here.
Maybe. Doesn't involve board shorts, though. I don't know. I understand that, like, maybe you and, like, your fellow hair gelers are, like, really into that kind of culture, but that's not for me.
Not so much. Not so much. Rohan, always appreciate it, man. Thanks for joining me.
Anytime, Chris.